Well, that was a week, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Friday today, the 17th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Cutting to the chase is what we are going to do at the top of the program today because, come on, this week, the Fed, interest rates, consumers, and retail, how much more of a setup does one need, Jordan Holman is at Bloomberg. Brian Chung is at Yahoo Finance. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, so Brian, let me start with you. And obviously, we're going to start with the Fed, 0.75 percentage point rate hike on Wednesday. Here's what I want to know from you. Had we been having this conversation last week, it would have been, oh, yeah, it's going to be 0.5 percentage point. That's what they've been saying, and that's what it's going to be. And then in like 4 days, it went from 50 basis points, 0.5%, to 75 basis points. And I want to know why.
Yeah, actually, I'm still stretching out my neck from the whiplash right from that one. I mean, if you rewind to Thursday yesterday or last week, expectations were for a 0.5 percentage point. And the reason why is because the Fed officials had been messaging for 5 weeks straight. That was the game plan, not only for June, but in their next policy setting meeting in July as well. But we got a fresh print on inflation last Friday showing worse than expected inflation at levels we haven't seen since 1981, as well as a consumer sentiment reading from the University of Michigan that was the weakest on record. And that got the Fed to change their plans and move last minute to a 0.75 percentage point of a move. There was messaging earlier in the week prior to the meeting announcement on Wednesday that that could be the case. And then ultimately, Jay Powell delivering on that promise. Now, of course, the next natural question is what happens next? The next policy setting meeting is scheduled for the end of July. Does that mean we're going to get 100 basis points or beeps or bips or whatever it is that people are calling? He was saying very clear in that policy setting press conference that, look, we're debating between 50 and 75 for the moment. But look, as we saw from the last one, they're going to be data dependent. Flexibility can happen at any time.
Yeah, that's what Powell says all the time. I will say here later on in the program, the Atlanta Fed president, Rafael Bostic, and I will pose him that question of why not a whole percent, and we'll see what he says. Jordan, let me ask you this. There was a lot of late data, as Brian talked about. We also learned this week that retail sales down just a touch April to May. I'm going to say that's a good thing, and I want you to back me up on that one and explain why.
For sure. So I think the important context here is that retail sales, like annual retail sales, have gone up since 2019 because throughout the pandemic, we didn't have money or we didn't have the ability to spend our money on going outside, essentially. So we were spending on stuff. So with the retail sales is going down a bit in categories like big ticket items like furniture or electronics, that's not all that surprising. Analysts have been flagging that this would be the case. And then to the other point about the tightening that we're seeing in the economy, it's kind of the point. So it's not, basically, it's not too surprising. And I think that's the biggest thing right now. People don't want more uncertainty than needed.
Brian, let me ask you this, just sticking on retail and people buying stuff. What's your concern level over the rise in services inflation, right? We've been buying goods now for 2 years plus, as Jordan was just talking about, and we are starting to do what we used to do, which is buy a lot of services, and there's some pent-up inflation there to be had.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a talking point that we had heard through some of the initial months of the high inflation was, well, people are buying a lot of goods. A lot of the drivers of headline inflation were because people were buying these types of things and goods that were stuck on ships or, you know, had material shortages that drove the prices higher. And then at some point, as maybe Americans started to shift what they were spending money on towards services, that it would be those other types that, you know, the other side of the coin that will be absorbing the price increases, which could lead to a, you know, lessening up for those first price pressures. But what we're seeing is that now services are getting a lot of price increases as well. And a big reason for that is the labor shortage, right? A lot of these businesses that are, you know, hair salons, for example, are finding it tough to find people to, you know, staff up the salon. And it, because of that, they have to drive wages up, and that drives ultimately what you're paying for a haircut as well. So there's really no reprieve happening in this market. And the broad-based nature of all this inflation is a big reason why it's not only a concern just to Americans seeing the price tags, but to policymakers as well.
Mitchell Hartman coming up on the labor market in about, 3 minutes or so now. But Jordan, let me ask you this. The retailers that you talk to, How worried are they about a possible, right? Let's not be predictive here, but the possibility that what is going on now results in a recession?
I think the retailers I talked to are being really thoughtful about the possibility of tough times coming up and that people might want to be more cost conscious despite whatever happens. So earlier this week, I was talking to the CEO of Kontoor, and they own the Wrangler and Lee jeans.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, you know, right now our customer, they're static. They're still buying things. But he flagged that they have different price jeans across the spectrum. So if someone is more price conscious, they're going to go to Walmart. Or if they're not, they're going to go to Nordstrom. And so I think what you're going to be hearing are retailers messaging this this value that they might have, because they still want shoppers to shop. It's just like, how do you convince them it's a safe thing to do?
Yeah. All right. I'm going to ask the same question to both of you, and I'll answer in your respective spheres. Brian, I wonder what your sense is of whether the market still has confidence in the Federal Reserve.
I think that's a pretty loaded question, but when you look at least
that's
the
why
bond
I asked
market,
it, man.
Right? Yeah. Oh, I love it. I love it. But when you look at the bond market, which is what a lot of Fed policymakers like to look at, I think that there is still confidence in the Fed. And the reason why is because even though you saw the massive pivot in the beginning of this week towards a 75 basis point increase that the markets and a lot of people had not been expecting prior to Monday of this week, you didn't see any sort of crazy volatility. You didn't see 10-year bond yields blow out at another 20 basis points or something like that in a single day, which tells me that markets had already been embracing the possibility that the Fed was going to have to get more aggressive. Now, of course, American consumers, and that was kind of the question that I asked the Fed chairman in the press conference, that's a whole different question. And I think that when you talk about the American consumer being 70% of the economy, that's a big reason why inflation is the way it is now, because it's the strength of the consumer. Very different story when you know that the R-word recession is at the talking point of every dinner table around the country, essentially.
Yeah, for sure. Jordan, then same question to you. Do corporate executives in your area of coverage have confidence in the Fed?
I would say right now, yes, because none of the retailers I talk to are saying we're not going to expand the business right now.
Oh, wow.
We can't move forward with the plans that we had.
Huh.
They might be adjusted a little bit, but I think that does signal some confidence in the Fed. It does signal some confidence in people buying things, and that's the core to their business.
Yeah. Jordan Holman of Bloomberg and Brian Chung at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Happy Friday.
You too. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
See you later. On Wall Street today, split on the session, down for the week. Details, numbers, all y'all know the drill, right? Okay, so as promised, Mitchell on jobs. After all the talk of interest rates and inflation and Jay Powell this and that, blah, 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 it seems relevant to remind everybody that keeping prices stable, the official way the Fed talks about inflation, right, price stability, that's only half of the central bank's job. The other part of what's called the dual mandate is maximum employment. And it's possible, at least to hear Jay Powell tell it, that maybe the Fed has done too good a job on that. Powell has said more than once in the past number of months that the labor market is unhealthily, even unsustainably hot. And so, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, there are some signs now that it's cooling off a bit.
If you live and breathe labor market metrics, like economist Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter, then the current employment picture is
very interesting at the moment. Boy, too interesting.
We've had this very hot market with low unemployment and two available jobs for every job seeker. But keeping that going is not the Fed's first priority. This week, says Pollack,
the Fed changed its tune somewhat and pledged a, quote, unconditional fight against inflation, even at the cost of rising unemployment.
For now, unemployment's still really low at 3.6%. But job postings are down at ZipRecruiter, especially in sectors vulnerable to rising interest rates, like real estate, home building, and advertising. Job creation is tapering off. In May, it was the lowest in a year. And, says economist Dana Peterson at the Conference Board,
we don't expect to see big increases in payroll employment anymore because we're pretty much back to where we were before the pandemic.
What we're seeing, it's like a beautiful summer day with clouds on the horizon.
That's Michael Gritton. He runs Kentuckiana Works, the workforce development agency in Metro Louisville. He says 80 employers showed up to a recent job fair for graduating seniors, including UPS, GE Appliances, Ford, all still recruiting like mad, but all watching the Fed, Gritton says, and waiting for a slowdown.
Everyone can see storm clouds brewing, and they just don't know how fast they're going to get here or how bad the storm's going to be.
Right now, the Fed predicts the national unemployment rate will reach 4.1% in 2024. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
$5. Five American dollars on the nose, a five spot. That is AAA's national average price for a gallon of gas today. It's down, actually, from yesterday when it was $5.009. I'm not making that up. AAA takes it out to the third decimal point. So, yeah, still not cheap. And those prices are throwing yet another wrench into whatever back-to-the-office plans the companies might be thinking up. Because it is no easy thing to find people who want to reintroduce the word commute to their vocabulary, let alone pay $100 or more to fill the tank for the privilege, am I right? Marketplace's Matt Levin reports now on the latest in the remote work tug of war.
Steve Hersey knows he's in a privileged position. He can work remotely, and if he absolutely had to, he could afford regular fill-ups at $5 a gallon. But if the Boston area robotics company he works for told him he couldn't work from home anymore, he'd still be annoyed at how much gas costs, especially because, you know, it's killing the earth.
It would be psychologically painful to be spending a great deal of money on gasoline for commuting.
After Delta and Omicron, employers' much-delayed return-to-office plans are being interrupted yet again. This time it's the Putin price pump pain thing, or whatever you're supposed to call it. Jill Chapman with the HR consulting firm Insperity says companies are responding with more carpool options and public transit benefits, or if all else fails.
Or you might say, instead of giving a Starbucks card for somebody who did, you know, the best on a project, going to give a gas card now.
But it's not just the commute that makes going into the office more expensive. That afternoon latte that was an excuse to escape the cubicle, that's pricier than it used to be. Same goes for that sad footlong you ate at your desk for lunch. Ravine Jesuthasan is with the consulting firm Mercer.
The broad issue, setting aside gas, is just the inflation we've seen in virtually everything.
So expect to see more company-provided lunches, maybe with a Texaco card as a side dish. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People sometimes can't believe that this still exists.
I don't know, but that doesn't sound like a good thing to me. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is down 38 points today, a tenth percent, 29,888. The NASDAQ gained 152, that's 1.4%, closed at 10,798. S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.2%, 36.74. For the week, and yes, it has only been a week, even though it felt longer, both the Dow and the NASDAQ down 4.8%. The S&P 500, even worse, lost 5.8%. Just heard from Matt Levin about gas and back to the office. Well, aside from gas, let's look at some stocks related to keeping that home office going, shall we? Apple up 1.1%. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise up 0.5%. International Paper crumpled 0.8%. Crumpled. Get it? That's pretty good. A lot of people in the C-suites are worried about the future. That's according to a new survey from the Conference Board of 750 CEOs. More than 60% of them anticipate a recession in their region by the end of next year or sooner. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is possible, I suppose, even in a program about business and the economy, for there to be too much talk of the Federal Reserve. Today, though, is not that day on this program, because when you get a chance to put questions to one of the people whose job it is to help run this economy, especially in an economic week like this one, well, you take it. Rafael Bostic is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Dr. Bostic, welcome back to the program. It's good to have you on again.
It's good to talk to you, as always, Guy.
Let me ask you this, sir. You have been pretty consistent saying that a half a percentage point was good for you. You actually even talked about, you know, maybe taking a pause in September. And here the Federal Open Market Committee comes out and says, you know what, we're going to go 0.75 percentage point. With the caveat that you're not a voting member of the FOMC this year, you good with that, 0.75 percentage point?
Yeah, I actually am good with that. You know, as you noted, I've been talking about the hope that inflation would start to come down on its own. You know, the data just doesn't say that. And if the data is not showing that inflation is moving down and by some measures actually getting worse, you know, that suggests to me that our policy is going to have to be a bit stronger. So, you know, the reports that we've seen recently, and, you know, we just actually did a survey of business inflation expectations, which shows that long run expectations for businesses are starting to creep up to levels that are concerning for me. And to me, all of that says that we need to act decisively and affirmatively to get inflation under control and start to bring it back down to our 2% target.
Okay, so look, why 0.75 percent? Why not just really whack it on the head and go a full percent?
You know, it's funny you asked that question. We had the same debate in my building. We called one of our crews the Go Big or Go Home crew. Right. I think from my view, if you think about the trajectory of where policy has been, not 3-4 months ago, a 50 basis point move was thought to be inconceivable. And so 75 is a pretty big move given where the mindset was about what our policy's actions were likely to be not too long ago. So for me, I do think this is actually going pretty big. And it definitely got people's attention in a way that I think I hope will be helpful in moving the economy back into a more sustainable level.
So along those lines of what you all had been communicating and the message you had intended to be giving, you know, so the modern day Fed, the present day Fed, right? So post sort of Greenspan has prided itself on its transparency and its communication strategy. And Chair Powell and the rest of you have been really clear about what you intend to do. And then you came out the other day and said, no, we're going to do something else than what we communicated. And I wonder if you're concerned at all about the Fed's credibility in this really tenuous time.
Yeah, you know, it's something, look, we are always concerned about our credibility, and we want to make sure we do things to preserve that credibility so that when we act, people respond to it, both in terms of businesses and consumers. But, you know, one thing I would just say and remind everyone, another part of what we've said in terms of how we're going to approach our policy actions is that we're going to be data dependent. And as data comes in, we're going to observe it, and then we'll adapt our policy as necessary. And I think this episode is a very good case of that, where there was new data that came in during a blackout period when we're not really going to go out and change that forward guidance. But we can't let those sort of details deter us from doing the things that the new information suggests is the right course of action.
Chair Powell said the other day that he believes a soft landing is still possible, but the path is getting more challenging. There are good things happening in this economy, right? I mean, labor market is strong and consumers, generally speaking, are still spending. What's your view on the path to a soft landing?
Well, I actually agree with the chair here. You know, I've been thinking for a long time that as strong as the labor market is, there is a lot of momentum, which should allow us to be able to attack inflation in ways that don't lead to deteriorations in labor market conditions so that we start to see losses in terms of jobs. I still think that's possible, but the numbers that have come in and the broadening of inflation suggest that we're not getting enough support from supply side resolution of challenges. And that means that we're going to have to be more muscular in our policies. I'm hopeful that as we go through the summer, we will start to see some of the supply issues resolve so that imbalance between demand and supply can narrow in ways that don't just rely on demand side policies, which is mainly what our policies are.
Thing is, though, Dr. Bostic, you know, a good chunk of the American public, and I know you've seen these surveys, whether they're anecdotal or internet or what have you, good chunk of the American public believes we're in a recession already, even though the underlying data don't support that. What do you say to those who are you know, in that recession vibe, you know, because that's the meme out there, right? The recession vibes.
Yeah, so I understand that. Look, inflation is very hard. And for most Americans, they've never lived in an inflationary environment. And, you know, I live this just like everybody else. I go to the grocery store. I see the higher cost for goods. I fill my gas tank and see amounts that are much higher than they've been historically. And that is going to weigh on your psyche. But to me, I think the best way to address this is, first of all, to note that there are some good things still happening in the economy. And then second, that we're attacking inflation and we're going to do all that we can to get it back down to a more normal level, which for us is going to be 2%. And we'll do whatever it takes to make that happen. And we are with the American people in trying to make sure that the pain that is experienced and the discomfort is as short-lived as possible.
Dr. Rafael Bostic, he's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Dr. Bostic, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it as always.
I look forward to the next time, Kai.
Minimum wage, you know, right? Federally, $7.25 an hour. State by state, sometimes more. But there's also something called sub-minimum wage. It's on the books, an exception to the Fair Labor Standards Act that lets some certified employers pay some workers, specifically workers with disabilities, less than that $7.25. I mention it because this week the Department of Labor announced it's suing a Montana ranch that employs people with disabilities and paid them as little as $1.17 an hour. Subminimum wage is not without controversy, but as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, it does have its advocates, too.
In 2022, the idea of anyone in America being paid about a dollar an hour is pretty jarring, says Cyrus Huncharik with the National Disability Rights Network.
It is shocking. People sometimes can't believe that this still exists.
Lawmakers started to look at opportunities for people with disabilities to work when veterans started returning from the Civil War and then World War I. Then came the 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act, says Peter Blank, a law professor at Syracuse University.
The below minimum wage program was kind of a product of its time that was not charity, but was a sense that people with disabilities could in some ways be employed.
But in the last century, thinking and laws around disability and employment have evolved, says Julie Christensen with the Association of People Supporting Employment First.
People with disabilities are the only protected class who are exempted from the minimum wage. So it is a civil rights issue.
She says the low-paid programs hold participants back from greater independence. But the prospect of shutting them down completely has some people concerned. Nina North Murphy is a retired social worker in St. Louis whose adult son participates in a sub-minimum wage job program. She says other jobs haven't worked out.
He has extreme limited language ability, so he can't communicate a lot of times when he's in trouble or he needs help.
Without the program, she says he'd likely end up at adult daycare. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, with which I do not even know what to do. It's a press release from Meta. That's Facebook and Insta and all the rest of the companies Mark Zuckerberg owns. Anyway, I'm just going to read you the tweet that I saw this morning. Here it is. Need a fresh fit for your avatar? We're launching our Avatars store on Facebook, Instagram, and Messenger so you can buy digital clothes. I mean, okay, but really? And also, all you kids? Get off my lawn. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. It's a quick update to the story that Mitchell, I think it was, did for us yesterday about central banks around the world raising interest rates. Yes, it definitely was Mitchell. Anyway, not on that list, Japan. The Bank of Japan said today it is keeping its benchmark interest rate right where it is. Thank you very much. -0.1%. Inflation over there, by the by, 2.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.